University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Charles Chappell of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Chief of the Solar Terrestrial Physics Division of the Space Science Laboratory, Chappell will speak on the solar terrestrial environment, a challenge in global ecology and stewardship. He presently directs a research group studying the physics of the Sun-Earth environment. Chappell served as mission scientist for the 1983 flight of Space Lab 1, and in 1985 was selected as alternate payload specialist for the Atlas 1 mission, which is scheduled to fly on the space shuttle in the early 1990s. He received the NASA Medal for Exceptional Scientific Achievement in both 1981 and 1984. Chappell received his bachelor's degree from Vanderbilt University and his doctorate in space science from Rice University in 1968.
Well, it's a pleasure for me to be here, and I have to say that I have been very much impressed with sort of the friendliness, the enthusiasm of the faculty and the students, and it's been a particular honor to get to interact with Harvey Potthoff in his class last night, and then to be with you in the forum today. I think you have something very special going on here at Wesleyan, and you ought to be very proud of what you have. I feel comfortable here in that my father taught at a Methodist college in Alabama for 40 years. He retired a couple of years ago, and I grew up on a college campus, which is one of the real treats of life, because you have one of the largest playgrounds in the world to grow up on, and everybody watches after you and keeps you out of trouble. So I feel very much at home. We're living in very exciting times. The rush of technology is changing the world very rapidly. It's making it smaller. It's making it more interactive. It's making it more fragile, more interdependent. And issues tend to quickly become world issues. Things like economics or environmental issues or political issues, military issues. The people of the planet are being driven inextricably toward a one-world perspective. We can't continue to live in the world and sort of do our own thing. We have to start thinking about how what we do affects everybody else. Fortunately, this same rush of technology is giving us the means to deal with this world compaction and interdependency. And it's the technology that's causing this compaction is also giving us the means to deal with it. For example, we have space-borne communications now in the financial area that allow you to gather data from any part of the world on what's going on in this market or that market. If you go to New York and go to Wall Street and go up on the top of the World Trade Center and into some of the financial institutions, they're sitting there looking constantly at what's going on all over the world when they're buying and selling money or futures or whatever. And the space-borne communications let you do that. Satellite-based television allows us to see each other continuously and to sort of gain an empathy for other cultures. And that helps us immensely politically. We can begin to feel what other people feel in their situations, and that helps us come together politically. The fusion technology of nuclear war finds equal application to electrical power generation for developing countries. It's something we can do. It's the same kind of technology. The research that we do in nuclear fusion for war machines can be used for electrical power development that will be for the good of everybody. And space-borne observations of the global environment allow us to understand its workings and to measure our influence on the environment, on the global environment. Therefore, technologically, we're prepared to deal with the challenges of the present world that we've created. And it only takes a slight shift in our direction, in our thrust. It takes a policy of decision-making that has a one-world perspective. That is, the idea that we're all in this thing together. What I'd like to do today is talk with you about one element of the One World perspective, and that is the environment, the idea of global ecology, the idea of looking at the environment of the Earth as just one environment that we're all enjoying, that we're all influencing. I want to look at what the environment is in a global sense, how we can study it, and then what choices we have in the future in protecting it. The space program is, I'm very convinced, the means by which we'll come to understand the global environment and the basis on which we can make the worldwide legislative decisions that are required to protect the environment. See, we're dealing with something that we, in a global sense, that we don't understand very well. And we're doing these experiments. We're sort of doing things to the environment all the time. We don't really know what we're doing in a lot of cases. And then we try to decide, well, are we doing the right thing or the wrong thing? And we don't really have the knowledge base to say whether what we're doing is right or wrong. So we tend to react and make laws anyway and say, well, you can't use spray cans or you can't use whatever. But we're not really sure what we're doing. And that's not a healthy situation to be in. You would rather understand the system you're dealing with well enough that the laws that you write can be the laws that affect things appropriately, that are not written out of fear, but that are written out of knowledge. So what I want to do at the beginning is talk to you a little bit about what the solar terrestrial environment is. Now, solar terrestrial is a fancy way of saying sun-earth environment. That is, the total environment that the Earth finds itself in, the sun, the changing sun, the connections between the sun and the Earth, and then all that is the Earth's environment. That part of it that we sense every day and the context in which that part fits into the global environment. Interestingly, when astronomers first looked out from the Earth, they saw the sun, they saw the planets, and they saw the stars, but they looked right through a huge dynamic region of magnetic fields and plasmas which were changing constantly and which were affecting the environment. But unfortunately, which couldn't be seen with the human eye. A plasma, for all of you in biology, the plasma I'm talking about is not the plasma you're used to. A plasma is an ionized gas. So it's what's called, it's the fourth state of matter. On the Earth, we experience the three basic states of matter of solid, liquid, and gas, and we feel like that's kind of all there is. But there is a fourth state of matter, and that is where you take a gas, like the gas in this room, which is electrically neutral, and you separate an electron off of each atom, and so it leaves the atom with a positive charge and you have a negatively charged electron. And you let those move through each other without ever coming back together again. So a plasma is a gas, but it's ionized as opposed to being electrically neutral. And it turns out that that here on the Earth, we're in just a tiny corner of the universe where plasmas are not sort of easily seen natural phenomena. Most of the universe is in the plasma state. We're here on the surface of the Earth in a very abnormal situation with regard to the rest of the universe. 99.999% of the universe is in the plasma state. All the stars are made out of ionized gases. All of the interplanetary medium, all of the regions around all of the planets, around the moons, the sun, everything, just about everything is in the plasma state. So it's important to understand how plasmas work. The fact originally that astronomy was, or space science was based on things you could see and not things that you had to go measure, meant that optical astronomy sort of got a jump on everything, because when you first looked out, the astronomers saw the stars. They began to try to understand their motions and the motions of the Earth and the sun, all of this sort of thing, because it could be seen. And it was only really with the space program 25 years ago, the beginning of the space program, that we could begin to measure plasmas, that we could get out away from the Earth into this environment in which solids, liquids, and gases are not the dominant thing, but plasmas are. If we could see plasmas in magnetic fields and we looked outward from the Earth, what would we see? The first slide, if we can have that, shows a picture of the sun-Earth environment. Now, on the left side is sort of the surface of the sun, You'll all be happy to know that the distance between the sun and the earth has been foreshortened here for artist's license. If we were that close, we'd be in a lot of trouble. This shows the surface of the sun, and the lines extending out from the sun represent the sun's magnetic field. As it is drawn outward by the ionized gas that blows out from the surface of the sun, and the region in between the sun and the earth is filled with a phenomenon called the solar wind. It's blowing continuously. It bathes the entire solar system. It bathes particularly the earth. It moves at very high velocities, 500 miles per second, extremely high velocities, blows past the earth. Fortunately, the earth has a magnetic field, which is shown around the earth. There you can see the earth in the center, fairly small. The magnetic field reaches out to maybe 100,000 miles toward the sun, and then it is blown out into a long tail, millions of miles in the anti-solar direction. The magnetic field of the earth protects the earth from this streaming hot plasma that comes from the sun. If we didn't have our magnetic field, the sun's solar wind would blow right down to the top of the atmosphere, would interact with the atmosphere, and would probably erode the atmosphere, and then would begin to infringe on the habitability module that we need down here around the Earth. So it's a good thing we've got the magnetic field. Particles stream out of the sun, plasmas, like we talked about, charged particles, and they can interact with the Earth's magnetic field, and they can become trapped in the Earth's magnetic field. In addition, the Earth itself can supply plasmas off the top of the atmosphere. When the space shuttle flies, it flies in the ionosphere. Space shuttle normally flies at a couple of hundred miles up. That's above the neutral atmosphere that we live in. And it is in the ionosphere, which is a shell of plasma, or a shell of ionized gas. And all of that gas is available to move up and down the magnetic field lines. You can see the magnetic field lines penetrate the Earth, both in the northern and southern latitudes. And the charged particles are trapped on those field lines. They spiral around them, and they're free to move back and forth. So this is really what the solar terrestrial environment is. And if you say, I want to understand everything about the environment I live in and how it changes, you need to study this, because you need to understand how the sun is going to change and how the changing sun is going to affect the Earth. For a long, long time, the sun was viewed as nearly perfect. In fact, it took on religious significance in a lot of different cultures. It was unblemished. It was unchanging. It was sort of the anchor point for the Earth's orbit. It was the center of our attention, our source of energy. And it was invariant. We didn't need to worry about the sun. It was always going to be there. Galileo, when he designed his first telescope, spent a lot of time looking at the sun, and he found spots on it. He reported those, and he had a lot of trouble with those reports because at that time it came into conflict with what was generally thought the sun was about. That is, the sun did not have any blemishes on it. It was fairly perfect. We now know that the sun is incredibly variable, continuously variable. And if you look at the sun in other wavelengths of light, the picture that you see now shows the sun in just visible light if you could look at it just straight out. And you can't see very much on it. If you look closely, you can begin to see sunspots. I don't advise you to do that without doing it the right way, because the ultraviolet light will damage your eyes pretty severely. But there are ways to project the image on a piece of paper, and then you can see the spots. But if you look at the sun from above the Earth's atmosphere, because the Earth's atmosphere filters out a lot of different wavelengths of light. But if you take your telescope above the atmosphere and look at the sun, you get a very different picture. And this is a collage of segments of the sun viewed in different wavelengths. These pictures were taken from Skylab, which is the first space station that our country had more than 10 years ago. And it shows the sun in different wavelengths, and you see not something that's invariant, but something that's incredibly changeable. In the upper left, you see the visible light, the sort of yellow color, with a spot. To its left, you see the sun as it looks if you view it in X-rays. That is, instead of looking at visible light in the few thousand angstrom range, you look at X-rays. And you see these incredible hot spots on the sun where they're coiled and changing magnetic fields that are accelerating the particles and causing them to emit X-rays. The bright spot there on the left-hand panel is an active region on the sun. The lower left is if you look at solar magnetic fields. They're changing continuously, and they're changing in ways that generate flares, which give out bursts of energy that come past the Earth. In the lower right is if you look in a wavelength H-alpha, and you can see a lot of the surface features of the sun, this boiling that's taking place continuously on the surface of the sun. In the right-hand picture is the corona, the fact that the gas is heated in ways that we still don't understand to very high temperatures and blown off the surface of the sun to travel through space past the Earth. That shows the intensities in the corona. And then the upper right-hand picture is if you look at the sun in ultraviolet wavelengths. You see lots of hot spots changing small, crushing configurations of magnetic fields, generating energy, liberating energy, and in fact blowing off large clouds of plasma like the prominence you can just barely see in the upper part of the picture. So the sun is extremely variable. I've got another picture of the corona. This would be a picture like you would have seen before, but it shows the variability in the corona. It's where you put a telescope up and you put a disc to mask out the light of the sun, and then you just look at the very faint light around the sun. It's usually done during an eclipse, or you can actually put a disc in your telescope and do the same thing. But you can see on either side the corona, this expanding region of gas has different shapes and different dynamics to it. And this moves out past the Earth. And if you're sitting out at the Earth and the sun rotates and these different forms of the corona come by and different streaming velocities of the gas, that's going to change the Earth's magnetic field and the Earth's plasma environment continuously. So the sun is quite variable. Now the magnetosphere, and this is another schematic, the magnetosphere represents that region around the Earth that's dominated by the Earth's magnetic field. And that is shown as this sort of comet-shaped region. The Earth, again, is the tiny ball in the center. The sort of donut-shaped region near the Earth there is a depiction of the Van Allen radiation belts. The first thing that we really discovered about energetic particles in the Earth's environment, done by James Van Allen from the University of Iowa. And that was the first thing we measured. Since then, as we've been able to measure more and more energies of particles, we found that this region is just full of plasmas. And it's full of plasmas of all variances of energies, from a few electron volts to millions of electron volts, moving at slow velocities, high velocities, radically different densities. And we're beginning to think that a lot of the plasmas that are trapped in this environment may come from the Earth itself and not from the sun, as we have always thought. And somehow the particles can move from the ionosphere up into the magnetosphere and become energized. And when they become energized, they can be shot back down into the atmosphere. And when an energetic electron interacts with a gas like we have in the top of the atmosphere, it causes the gas to emit light. And when it emits light, it puts on an incredible light show, which you may, in fact, have seen some of here in Nebraska. I don't get to see it this very often in Alabama, but it's the Aurora Borealis. This is a picture that Lou Frank from the University of Iowa took with his instrument on Dynamics Explorer, and it shows the Earth, and you can see the aurora around the top, sort of the halo around the Earth. And it goes all the way around the Earth, and it's in both poles, around both poles. Depending on whether it's summer or winter, there may be enough background sunlight that you can't see the aurora, but it's always there. It's always there around both poles. And during enhanced magnetic conditions, it moves to lower latitudes. Like it'll move from, typically it's in Canada, it'll move down across the northern U.S. in stormy magnetic times. That is, times in which the sun is putting out an enhanced flow of solar wind plasma. You can also see some arcs near the equator. Those are called tropical arcs, and that's a chemical phenomenon that has to do with the ionosphere. So we're looking at the aurora. There's another picture of the aurora. You can see the terminator of the Earth, the sunlit side on the left, and then the arc, the partial halo, shows the aurora. And the spottiness of the aurora represents impulsive injections of energy into the atmosphere that will cause the atmosphere to be heated, and that will cause the atmosphere to move in a different way. the aurora as you'd see it from the ground, a picture taken from Alaska. The aurora is in arcs, rays, moves continuously. It dances. It's pretty eerie because there's no sound. There's this incredible light show and no sound. The Eskimos worship the aurora. It's a very almost spiritual phenomenon to watch it. The aurora takes place in the top part of the atmosphere, about 100 kilometers above the surface of the Earth. The atmosphere is divided into different layers. The weather that we deal with is in sort of the first 5 or 6 miles up in the atmosphere. It's called the troposphere. Above the troposphere, there is a region called the stratosphere, which goes from the order of, I'll change into kilometers, 15 kilometers up to about 50 kilometers. Stratosphere is very important to us because it has ozone, which absorbs the ultraviolet from the sun, and that's what protects us on the surface of the Earth from the solar ultraviolet. And we'll come back and talk about ozone a little bit more. Above the stratosphere is the mesosphere, from 50 to 80 kilometers. It's a region that we don't really know very much about. And then above the mesosphere, from 80 kilometers on up to 100, 120, is the thermosphere, which is the region where you find the aurora, where there's a lot of dynamic wind motion and a lot of chemistry that takes place as a result of things that come down from the magnetosphere. That is, the energetic particles that come in from the Earth's magnetosphere heat the atmosphere, cause the atmospheric winds to blow in different directions, change the chemistry of the atmosphere, and all of this stirs up through the atmosphere in ways that we don't understand. We've got some ideas, but we can't really predict it very well. In addition to the solar wind, the sun's energy output varies continuously. And that's really a bother. That's really a concern. Because the Earth's environmental system depends on a good, steady source of energy. And the sun's energy is changing. The total energy output, that is the, say, watts per square meter that hit the surface of the Earth, has been changing. We've been able to measure it accurately over the past, the order of 5 years, and it's decreasing. It's decreasing by only tenths of a percent, which isn't much, but if you model the atmosphere and say, what would this decreased energy cause, you can get some pretty drastic results. That is, it looks as if maybe the atmospheric temperature could begin to change by the order of degrees, the average temperature of the Earth, which would change climate very drastically. So we're concerned that we need to understand the energy-producing mechanisms in the sun and how the sun's total energy is changing. This is electromagnetic energy, the light that comes out of the sun. How is that changing continuously? And it is changing, and it seems to be affected by the features that are on the surface of the sun. It has a lot of variation in it, and it's showing a slow trend downward in energy. So it's a very tightly coupled system. This illustrates the magnitude of energy that comes from the magnetosphere into the atmosphere. If you keep looking, you'll see the United States and the lights of the major cities in the United States. And then all of that incredible stuff across the top is the aurora. That's the light from the aurora that's caused by the energetic electrons that come into the top of the atmosphere. Now, the red things are sort of superimposed graphs that show the intensity of the flux of particles that are coming in, the electrons that are coming down into the atmosphere. But the large white areas represent this incredibly large region of the aurora in which energy is dumped continuously into the atmosphere, and that energy causes the atmospheric dynamics to change. And we've got to try to understand that because that's a continuously changing influence on the environment. So we're dealing with a tightly coupled system. The sun changes, the solar wind changes, the magnetosphere responds, the magnetosphere dumps a different amount of energy into the atmosphere changes, the atmosphere responds in its dynamics. It's going on continuously, and that's the natural part of the phenomena. Our challenge is to try to understand what's going on naturally. Now, there's another side to the equation. That is, all of us are here, and we're doing things to the environment as well. So the sun is changing continuously, and it's changing the environment, and we are changing the environment. Man's influence now is becoming of global proportion. And let me give you a couple of examples of that. We're only seeing symptoms now. So we're doing all these things, and the atmosphere is, and the oceans are sort of doing what they can to handle what we're doing. And you see a symptom every once in a while of, whoops, you did something that wasn't good. You know, and we don't know what we did, but it wasn't good. Something changed, and it wasn't good. Let me give you some examples of that. The ozone I mentioned a minute ago, and I want to talk about that a little bit more. In the 1970s, when the country was thinking about doing the SST and the shuttle, some of the guys who didn't want us to want the country to do the supersonic transport said, "Well, you know, it's going to fly in the stratosphere, and its exhausts are going to it's going to put out chemicals that'll probably attack the ozone somehow, and so we don't want to do the SST." So NASA said, "Well, gee, we ought to go try to see if we can understand what's going to happen as a result of that, and make sure that the shuttle, when it launches and goes up through the stratosphere, that it doesn't damage the stratosphere." So we started trying to do studies and trying to understand things. And we found, indeed, that the supersonic transport, had we ever built it, and the shuttle will not damage the stratosphere in any significant way. But what was found out in these studies was that, gee, if you want to worry about damaging the stratosphere, you better start worrying about spray cans, because the freon, the amount of freon that we're putting into the Earth's atmosphere, can eat the stratosphere alive. So this study where we set out to make sure we weren't going to hurt anything with the shuttle ended up telling us every spray can we were using was a bad deal. We didn't even know we were doing that. The deal with freon that makes it kind of unique is that it's inert. That is, it's used for a lot of things because it's a gas that doesn't combine with anything. It's very chemically inert. And so when you put it into the atmosphere, it just stays there. It doesn't go away. It's not broken down. In the lingo, it's not biodegradable. It goes in the atmosphere and just slowly rises in the atmosphere until it gets up to the stratosphere where the solar ultraviolet can hit it. And then that changes, the solar ultraviolet then changes it chemically, and then it becomes active. And it becomes active right in the middle of the region where the ozone is. Now, ozone is O3. That's three oxygen atoms together in a molecule. And the freon starts a catalytic reaction. Doesn't take much. It's parts per billion. It's all it takes. Doesn't take much. And it starts this catalytic chain, which starts destroying the ozone. That is, it changes O3 into O2. And O2 cannot absorb the ultraviolet. So all of a sudden, it starts eating away at the shield that you've got, that we have, to protect us from the ultraviolet. So we continued to, we said, gee, that's a problem, and we need to do something about that. But we weren't sure to what extent the freon was doing that. So a lot of states passed laws. Gee, you can't use spray cans. And we legislated out sort of out of fear. We said, as an indication, there might be something bad. We're not exactly sure what's happening, but we better be careful about that. So we passed a lot of laws. We continued to observe the ozone and to try to model it. And what we found was that we didn't know very much about the stratosphere at all, and the models we had didn't even do a good job predicting what was going to happen. So we thought, well, there's probably damage. We better do some damage control, that is, pass some laws, but we're still not sure what's going on. Now, just a year or so ago, there were measurements being made routinely of the ozone in the Antarctic, and a British researcher reported a 50% decrease in the ozone in the fall time frame over the Antarctic, a gigantic hole. You may have seen the NOVA program last week called The Hole in the Sky. There's this gigantic decrease or hole in the ozone layer over the Antarctic, and it's been verified by measurements now from another satellite in addition to these ground-based measurements. We're doing something that's not good. Just a couple of days ago, a group of scientists held a press conference to say that it looks like this hole in the ozone comes from both the wind patterns in the stratosphere, which are natural things, and from the addition of the chlorofluoromethanes, or freons, that we are all doing in all the industrialized nations. So there's reason to be concerned. There has been some progress. I think last week there was an agreement signed by 43 different nations that we will work toward decreasing the amount of freon that we produce. And they set a certain amount of percentage decrease by a certain time. That's not all the nations of the world by any means. And this is a global problem. It's something that all of the nations of the world are going to have to come together to handle. So we've got a symptom here. The atmosphere is saying, whoops, watch it. You did something you shouldn't do. And it's happening on a global scale. So we've got to address that. Okay, there's another symptom. You've heard about the greenhouse effect. We are continuously adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. The more trees we cut down, the slash and burn stuff, all of the petroleum we burn, everything we burn, putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We cut down more and more plants, which are the things we depend on to recycle carbon dioxide and oxygen. So we're building up carbon dioxide in the atmosphere pretty substantially. And we're not quite sure what that's doing. Now, the general feeling is that carbon dioxide gas in the atmosphere allows the sunlight to come through, which hits the surface of the Earth and is re-radiated in different wavelengths. The infrared part of that radiation that comes back from the surface of the Earth and that would normally go back out into space gets caught by the CO2 that's in the atmosphere and trapped. And so the Earth warms up. And that's what the greenhouse effect is. And the Earth is warming up. And the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is just going up and up and up. And this is a global deal. I mean, we're all putting it in. All of us living on this planet are putting it in. And some of the models predict that the mean temperature of the Earth will go up by several degrees within the next few decades. Now, several degrees is incredibly large. Several degrees starts to melt the polar ice caps. Melting polar ice caps change the depths of the oceans. If you live in San Francisco, you have to worry about things like that. If the ocean depth changes by 20 meters, there's going to be a lot of fishermen's wharf that will be inaccessible to all of us tourists in the near future. But the ocean patterns change, and then that changes climate. And then that means that regions which used to be great for farming aren't great for farming anymore. We have found statistically that there are drought patterns, there are areas of drought that seem to move back and forth. This happens all over the world, but in the United States, that move sort of in the Midwest region, and they seem to shift in response to changing solar conditions. We don't really understand why. Statistically, that shift seems to be there. But the models, and our models are very crude these days because we don't understand things well enough, the models say that that changes in the mean temperature of the Earth are going to cause very large shifts in these patterns of drought. And so things that we have come to depend on with respect to crop production in one area may well change. And you that's the kind of thing you want to know about. You want to know about it in advance and you want to deal with it. So this is a second symptom. We're putting carbon dioxide in. We're changing the environment. We're doing it globally, and we're doing it without much idea about what it's going to cause, and that's not a healthy thing to do. So these are symptoms that have surfaced, a couple of examples. There are going to be others. The atmosphere or the oceans are going to tell us something else one of these days. You shouldn't have done that. And one of the problems on these things is that it takes years and years and years to get back from where you've gotten. The changes we're making in ozone are going to take years and years and years to replace. It's not something you just cut it off and tomorrow it's okay. So you're doing things that have long-scale implications, and you have to deal with that. But to deal with it, you have to understand it well. So we've got to develop a knowledge of how the Earth's environmental system works. And I want to spend a few minutes talking about global ecology, because that's what we're getting toward now, is global ecology. Ecology, of course, is the study of the interrelationship of organisms with the environment that they live in. And ecology is a term I know that I first became aware of in the 1970s. We began to be concerned about ecology, it was largely on a local level. We started worrying about smog in Los Angeles. We started worrying about pollution of the stream in my town and what that would do to the fish and then what that would do to recreation and what it would do to the vegetation. We worried about, do we build a dam in Tennessee, the Tellico Dam, because it's going to change a stream that had a little fish called the snail darter, and that was the only place that fish was in the world. And if we change that, then we're going to eliminate that species. So we worried about ecology. We began to worry about ecology on a local scale, and that's very important. The local scale is very important. But what we're finding now by the couple nature of all of this is that you have to worry about ecology on a global scale. You can't worry about doing something in Lincoln and saying, okay, well, we're going to take care of the atmosphere over Lincoln or even over Nebraska or even over the United States. If you're doing something here to the atmosphere, you're starting to affect things globally. And every part of the world has to begin to recognize that. So the approach and the solutions have got to be global in their nature. So we're dealing with a system, an ecological system that's global in its extent. If you change one thing, it starts to change other things, and you should understand what those changes are going to be. If I cut down a lot of trees, it's going to change the runoff. That's going to put mud in the rivers. That's going to add soil and silt to the oceans and the estuaries. That's going to change the life, the system for life in the estuaries. That's going to change the interaction of carbon dioxide between the oceans and the atmospheres. You punch the system in one place, and it's going to punch back in another. And we have to begin to recognize that, and we have to begin to deal with that. So global ecology is a very challenging thing. I mean, it means you've got to try to understand and deal with this very large system. And, in fact, it's possible to do that. And, again, I think the space program is probably the place that's going to be our source of information, that's going to give us some breakthroughs. You can do things like put spacecraft in all of the different parts of the system. And, in fact, we have in our plans to do a lot of this. This particular chart shows the sun to the left, and then you sort of have an over-the-shoulder picture of the magnetosphere to the right, and there are different spacecraft placed throughout the system, ones that watch the solar wind as it moves away from the sun, others that remotely look at the sun and watch its surface change, its surface features change, others that measure the way the solar wind interacts with the Earth's magnetic field and gets particles in and energizes the particles, others that measure the way those particles are dumped into the atmosphere, others that measure the way the atmosphere changes, and others that look down at the surface of the Earth and measure constantly the amount of what they call desertification, the amount of desert, the amount of forest, the crop patterns, the changes in the ocean, the interaction of gases between the oceans and the atmosphere, dealing with the Earth as a system. And this is all entirely possible to do if we decide to do it. Finally, I want to touch a little bit on just what I would call stewardship of the Earth. The Earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein. We are all called upon to be stewards. And, of course, being a steward means to exercise responsible care over the possessions that we're entrusted with. And in this case, we're talking about exercising responsible care over the Earth that we are entrusted with. Christ spoke often in the parables on the idea of stewardship, whether it's taking care of the resources, utilizing the resources that you have effectively, whether it's your talents or your land or whatever. Stewardship is an important principle. So how should our nation approach the idea of stewardship? There are a couple of things we could do. We could just pull back and say, well, you know, we'll worry about taking care of our own corner of the Earth. We'll do our own thing. We can blame technology for getting us into all these problems, but we'll pull back, have the simple life. Let's get away from this interdependency. Let's not worry about other folks. That would, if we took that approach, that would be not only short-sighted, but it would be entirely wrong, because the dominant pressures that we're beginning to feel on the Earth are not those that necessarily come from technology. They're the pressures that come from the growing population. And the population is going to grow whether we have technology or not. It took 1 million years to produce on the earth the first billion people. It took 1 million years to produce the first billion people. Today, we produce a billion people in 13 years. In the next 40 years, more people will be added to the earth. That's all y'all are going to be around then. The next 40 years, more people will be added to the earth than have been added in all history up to now. And this is going to happen with or without technology. Okay, so this planet that we're all in together has got to support all of this. We've got to understand how to best utilize the resources that we have. And the resources of energy and food are being used at such a rate at the present time that in the near future we won't be able to support the population. And in the near future, we will have messed up the ecology to such an extent that we may well have disrupted this life support system, the planet, that we've got to depend on. So all of this kind of cries out for a stewardship, and a global stewardship, really, conducted with a one-world concern and perspective. The space program can give us the knowledge to understand the solar terrestrial environment, can make the observations, and through these observations, we can generate the models. The view of the Earth from the Moon, the one that you see in front of you now, has been striking in its impact on our feelings about the environment. You look at this picture and you don't see any borders. I mean, there are not any countries there. They're just people, earth, water, clouds. We are really all in this together. The one world perspective can begin to bring nations together, because we've got a difficult thing ahead of us, that is to exercise a global stewardship. But out of that can come a strength, in that we have a common goal. We can join arms with other nations to understand the environment and protect it. We can, through a space effort to understand the environment, do a lot toward turning people's attention away from fighting each other and turning their attention toward joining with each other for the common good of the Earth. The U.S. should take a leadership role in this press for global stewardship. It's the right role for our country. It displays the care for the well-being of humankind that this country has prided itself in throughout its history. In the space program, we reach outward from Earth toward new worlds like the Moon and like Mars. But in reaching out, we are continuously learning about our own planet and are solidifying our harmonious environment with our home planet. And as we reach out, we are venturing forth not from a country, but from a planet. You begin to continue to have this feeling of one world perspective, the need to get into this together. This sense, this one world perspective and the need to understand the planet Earth has been recognized. And in the current plans within the U.S. space program, we have not only a thrust and a desire to reach out, to build a space station, to populate, to build a colony on the Moon, to reach out to Mars, but we have the desire to have a mission, what we call a mission to planet Earth, which will be aimed at gaining the understanding necessary to protect the solar terrestrial environment. The mission could be a worldwide cooperative venture, because it is, after all, studying the planet which houses us all. It's not just for the U.S. Someone must, however, take the first steps. As a nation, we are technically able. The costs are well within our grasp. The biggest challenge that we face is just the challenge of deciding to do it. And it's up to you to make that decision. Thanks.
Today on University Forum, we've heard Charles Chappell of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. He spoke on the solar terrestrial environment, a challenge in global ecology and stewardship. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private, undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.